Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Snakes, zombies, sharks, heights, speaking in public. The list of fears is endless. But while you're clutching your blanket in the dark, wondering if that sound in the hall was actually a footstep, the real danger is in your hand when you're behind the wheel. And while you might think a great white shark is scary, what's really terrifying and even deadly is distracted driving. Eyes forward, don't drive distracted. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, I was made to build things, and I build them quite well. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Polkabaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today, we are going to be tackling a listener request.
Yes, this is a listener request that's from Kris, and Kris sent us an epic email.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's an incredible email. Fantastic. Thank you so much, Kris.
Basically a sci-fi novel.
It's long, but we're not going to read the whole thing, but I'll give you the gist of what Kris was talking about. Kris was talking about the combination of multiple disciplines to allow us to explore the universe ultimately with robots that would give us a telepresence in wherever those robots could go so that we could kind of experience that ourselves. So we're talking about a combination of different factors. Advances in robotics, where the robots, particularly humanoid robots, would be able to go around and explore things. The ability to send those signals back to us using a user interface that's similar to virtual reality or augmented reality headsets,
mm-hmm.
and the ability for us to control those robots in real time or as close to real time as possible so that we can experience what it's like being on these remote places, including places across the galaxy.
Right. This is like a step above rovers and into full-on robotic avatars.
Yes. So we wanted to talk about the possibility of that and some of the challenges that we face in order to get to a point where we could have robotic avatars. And in some ways, we're really close. And in other ways, for some applications, there's some problems that may, in fact, be insurmountable.
Yeah, well, we may be coming up against problems that we often encounter when trying to interface between technology and our brains.
Yeah, exactly.
But we've talked about this on the show before, but maybe we should just do a real quick refresher on why it is you'd want to have robots in space exploration as opposed to human astronauts.
Right, right. And why you would want to have a robot, you know, avatar in the first place. Now, there are some reasons why you would want one just here on Earth. And one of the great stories we'll be covering later is looking into research of using a robotic avatar for people who are otherwise incapable of moving, right?
Sure, yeah.
It gives them the ability to have a robotic body do things on their behalf, and they can control it in various ways. So that's one reason. But the other one being for space exploration or other means here on Earth, robots can go places we can't.
Yeah, we've got these delicate, squishy human bodies that don't breathe the vacuum of space and, you know.
Yeah, cold, yeah. Cold, really super cold temperatures kind of mess with us.
Radiation is bad.
Super hot temperatures mess with us.
We're just not that great.
Yeah, no. Organic matter has limitations.
Yeah.
And some of those are limitations that mechanical or electromechanical or synthetic materials either do not experience or experience to a lesser degree.
Well, yeah, there are a couple ways you want to look at this. One of them is simply that it can't, like a robot can do things a human couldn't do. It can actually accomplish a mission that we would not be able to complete.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that we don't have to value robots as much. Like, it's okay to send a robot on a suicide mission. You don't have to feel bad about it.
Mm-hmm. Right. It may end up being a large financial obligation, but still, that's very different than putting a human life in danger.
Oh,
right?
sure. And, you know, sentencing someone to never see their family again,
right,
or never use Facebook again, or...
Right, right. Or just...
Never see Gremlins 2 again. Actually, I'm getting into an area where I wouldn't mind giving those things up, but
Gremlins 2 is still amazing. It's also one of those things where we could send them to, even if it's not a one-way mission, we could send them to places that would be extremely risky for humans, and that includes places here on Earth. Obviously, we use robots for that now.
Yeah.
Oh, sure, for deep sea exploration.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there are also reasons a robot could complete a mission that humans couldn't complete, apart from the fact that it, like, the environment might kill a human.
Sure.
It can also be that robots can have scientific precision that humans don't naturally have. Unless
exactly.
They have
with our dumb, meaty
kind
fingers.
Of, right,
yeah.
Unless we have some kind of tool or something.
Yeah, robots can move on a level of precision that is far greater than what humans can accomplish, and we've been putting that to good use here on Earth as well. Also, robots can have an array of sensors on them that give them access to a lot more information than what we humans can access with just our natural senses,
mm-hmm.
Right? So
yeah.
their robots are capable of quote unquote seeing in a spectrum that's much more broad than our visible spectrum that we're limited to,
because of our dumb, meaty eyes,
right. And yeah. They can also, quote unquote, hear. I mean, pretty much any sense you can think of, we can build sensors that are much more sensitive to that information than our natural senses.
The robot can have an onboard mass spectrometer, which, I mean, we have a tongue, but
yeah,
it's just better to use the spectrometer than to go tasting the dust of Mars.
This tastes radioactive. Yeah, that's not necessarily a good thing.
Okay, well, so obviously it's not a new idea to use robots controlled by humans in certain conditions,
mm-hmm.
where they would be, you know, preferable or more useful or at least, you know, better to put in harm's way.
Sure.
For example, one thing I've seen plenty of pictures and video of before is bomb disposal robots.
Yeah,
this makes total sense.
This was one of the ones that leapt to mind when I was thinking about this, sort of like the predecessors to the types of robots that Chris was asking about in the email we received. So bomb disposal robots have been around for a while. The earliest one I could find was designed in 1972 by Lieutenant Colonel Peter Miller. I say lieutenant because he was in the British Army. His bomb disposal robot was built as a matter of necessity. At the time, the British Army was dealing with a lot of car bombs that were being left by the Irish Republican Army,
mm-hmm.
and so, or rather the Irish Republic Army. And so he wanted to find a way to be able to pull cars that might have explosive devices in them to a safe zone, surrounded by sandbags, that sort of thing, so that it could be detonated without putting people in harm's way. And a lot of the times before he had made the first bomb disposal robot, it was essentially the job of somebody who was very brave and padded down as much as possible, armored up, to physically go look into a car, sometimes having to open a car door, which could be a triggering device, mm-hmm. to get access to a bomb. So they were trying to find a way to make this safer. And he came up with the idea when he was thinking back on something else he had done. It turned out that that Peter Miller was something of a tinkerer and someone who often would think, how can I make this easier? And one of the things he thought about was a way to make it easier for him to mow the lawn so that he didn't have to do it personally. And what he did was he did something really simple. He had a lawnmower that had powered wheels so it could move on its own once you apply, you know, gas to it, mm-hmm. essentially. He tied a rope to it, put a stake in the ground that the rope was attached to, and let it go. So it would go in a circle, and every time it completed a circle, it was winding the rope around the stake that was tall enough in it.
There would be a shorter length of rope on the next go around.
So it was a concentric circle.
So it's like an early mowing Roomba.
It's brilliant in theory. For some reason, that seems like it wouldn't actually work in practice. But
it worked for him enough for him to think, maybe I can come up with something similar, but use it for this very dangerous activity. And he thought, well, the lawnmower wouldn't really work as well. And he saw someone using a motorized wheelbarrow. And he literally went to the garden center, bought a motorized wheelbarrow, brought it back to headquarters. They were given carte blanche to do whatever they needed in order to actually put this thing together. So they disassembled the wheelbarrow, so they just had the chassis. And they created a robot that had a tow hook on it. It was essentially a grappling hook. And they could power it remotely. And by remotely, I mean they tied ropes to the controls.
by power, you mean human power.
Human
yes.
power, yeah. There was a human standing several feet back using ropes to guide and power the wheelbarrow as it would move to a car. And in fact, they had to test this out almost immediately. They had to go to Belfast with it. They used it to hook a car, and it started to tow the car back. However, and it was actually there was another vehicle, I believe, that was connected to it to help it pull back because the wheelbarrow wasn't strong enough to tow a car, I don't mm-hmm. believe. However, what happened was the wheelbarrow unfortunately fell over during that first real life. It wasn't even a test. This was a real life use of it. This was before they had really had a chance to test this thing. It fell over on its side. And they ended up detonating the car by rockets, where it ended up after it had been towed just a short distance. But they still considered it a success because it didn't require someone to get into harm's way to pull the car further away from. It was actually at a car dealership is where the car was.
Oh
found.
My goodness! Mm-hmm.
So they considered it a success, and in fact, Peter Miller would go on to oversee the development of more sophisticated robots, ones that had a true remote control ability, not just with ropes, mm-hmm. and ones that had more like an articulated arm, so it could do things like pick up a suspicious package and move it physically to a different location. It ended up being sort of the genesis of bomb disposal robots. And so we've got a lot more advanced ones now, including ones that have cameras so you can operate remotely and see what, quote unquote, see what the robot sees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, there's lots of other military use robots. A lot of them are used for simple reconnaissance missions.
Yeah.
In fact, the company that makes Roombas has military reconnaissance robots that are pretty awesome.
Yep.
But that gets us into our next bullet here, which is reconnaissance drones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so drones obviously being used for reconnaissance around the world right now. The earliest drones were really kind of electronic drones because you could count like unmanned balloons from the 19th century in that field if you wanted
really
to.
Really tragic time that they strapped bombs to bats and...
Yeah, that could be considered part of it too. But in this case, we're talking about electronic drones that were just used as target practice for combat pilots and anti-aircraft gunners. And then eventually, in the 1960s, the U.S. Air Force funded development of unmanned reconnaissance drones like the Ryan Model 147, also known as the Lightning Bug, which had to be launched from a Lockheed DC-130 Hercules airplane. They had cameras aboard the drones, but they were just taking series of photographs and had to be retrieved so that you could see what they had gotten.
Because the 1960s, they didn't have a satellite uplink to automatically. Yeah,
you weren't getting a live feed from the drone, so you actually had to find the drone after it had landed and retrieve it so that you could get the information that was captured. But this meant that you had an unmanned vehicle as opposed to someone flying like a U-2 spy plane, which, you know, had previously been shot down by the Soviet Union, so that was a big issue. In 1972, the Ryan model 147SC TV was introduced, which had a TV camera that sent a live feed to the DC-130 drone controller aircraft. No telling if the SC TV also had Canadian humor on it.
Oh.
Yeah. How many of you are familiar with that sketch show? That's a dated reference right there. At any rate, today we've got lots of different drones with cameras on them that can give you a live feed, including consumer drones, the type of stuff like the Parrot AR drone where you can control it with a smartphone, get a live feed of the camera to your smartphone. You can play games with other people who own them, and you do a little like kind of tag-like games using your smartphone as the user interface. So these are commonplace now.
Yeah, and it's come a long way, baby.
Yeah, and so again, this is a way of us extending our presence beyond our immediate surroundings, right? Mm-hmm. Although still fairly, with the use of the consumer drones, it's still fairly modest.
You know, something that is a lot like a direct robotic avatar would be something like robotic surgery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that involves directly translating a human's movements into the movements of robotic arms and tools. That's sort of like just giving you this tiny direct presence inside somebody else's body, which is creepy.
Yeah, but also cool.
Yeah.
Sure. And like all robotics, this can work in a few different ways. Most of the robotic surgery things that exist today are shared control systems. And that just means that a doctor is directly using robotic equipment to perform a surgery. The robot in question here isn't really thinking, and it can't really react to anything that happens.
The robot doesn't decide where to cut.
Right, exactly. Now, telesurgery and doctor-supervised robotic surgery systems are in development, but, you know, telesurgery requires really good, really stable internet connections.
Right.
No one wants something to go terribly wrong in someone's body because the internet went down.
Yeah, you clearly can't have any latency issues either, because you need to, for example, a lot of these systems have warning algorithms in place so that if you start straying too close to a very sensitive area, let's say that you are performing a surgery to remove a cancerous tumor, for example, and you would start to get to a point where you're going to be cutting into healthy tissue. A lot of these have a system involved where you get a feedback to the surgeon, so the surgeon knows, even though they're not in the same space as the patient, that they can't go any further without potentially harming the patient.
Right. And there's a large process of scanning and a data collection that happens before any of these surgeries would start, so that frequently they'll kind of mark off areas around the edges where you're supposed to cut so that you get that feedback
warning.
Yeah,
you get the margin, I think is what they call it.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes they will even have stops in place to tell the robot, like, no, you do not move past this point.
Right.
Please and thank you.
Which makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. And then doctor-supervised robotic surgery requires just so much of that scanning and programming beforehand. And you know, like we've just been saying, these machines are not, or the computer programs really, aren't complex enough to stop or change plans if something goes wrong. So there's just an element of involved.
Yeah,
I think a lot of the questions about robot surgery are also involved sort of in the idea we discussed not too long ago about what happens if a robot breaks the law. The underlying question is, who's responsible for the autonomous actions of a robot? And so people probably just aren't yet comfortable with the idea of giving a robot full free reign, even when it might do as well as a human in practice.
Even scarier than a pushing robot is a robot that's already performing laparoscopic surgery on your heart.
Definitely.
But the concept is definitely awesome. You know, using tiny endoscopic cameras, a robot can show a surgical team in 2D or even 3D what's going on inside of a patient, and robots can make such small controlled movements so consistently, you know, without fatigue.
Yeah, no handshaking.
Right. You know, some surgeries take hours, like half a day even, and robots don't get tired and don't get shaky hands when they miss their 3 p.m. snack time.
Right,
exactly. And in that way, this really is a lot more like the idea of a robotic avatar than some of the other things we might consider.
Yeah.
Because the tools are becoming extensions of the doctor's hands.
Right, and they are enhancing the doctor's already formidable experience and abilities to the point where the doctor is capable of carrying out moves that may not have been possible under his or her own normal, you know, human motions.
Yeah.
So it one thing that this, another huge benefit this gives us is minimally invasive surgery, where you don't have to do the you know, you may not have to make a big incision in order to perform some of these surgical procedures, because you're able to make these very precise movements with tools that can go into a relatively small cut. And that also means that you have a faster healing time and less chance for infection. So yeah, there are other benefits as well.
Right. And so the question of, have we ever used anything like a robotic avatar in space exploration is a little different, though, than the kind of examples we've talked about before. So if you are controlling a bomb disposal robot or a robotic surgery tool like the Da Vinci robot, or even a drone that's, you know, pretty far away, it's still close enough that you can have direct interaction and control.
Yeah.
It might not be so, like, fully immersive, like you're becoming the robot, but there's some kind of analogy between that and having a robotic avatar. Space exploration is a little different for a few reasons, right?
Yeah. So one of those is that if we look at the history of using robots in space, you could argue that things like probes kind of sort of fit the bill in the sense that they have sensors on them that extend our ability to look or whatever into space, you know, depending upon the sensors. They typically have an antenna that will allow them to transmit information back to Earth and occasionally receive messages saying, hey, you need to do a small course correction. That's about the extent of the interaction between probe and Earth. It's mostly a data gathering system.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of autonomy and disconnectedness.
Yeah. Rovers, however, those are much more recent. They date really back to the 1970s when the Lunokhod rover launched by the then Soviet Union to the moon. That was a remote-controlled rover equipped with a camera that sent back images of the moon. The first unmanned rover to land successfully on Mars was the Sojourner in 1997. That was carried aboard the Mars Pathfinder spacecraft. And we've since used a few other rovers to explore Mars. And also we've used it to look at other, you know, rovers to look at other bodies as well. However, the further out we get, the more we're no longer talking about real time. And that's the big change between the ones we were talking about earlier, the ones where we're on the same planet as the robot. So the lag time in communication tends to be either undetectable or so short that we can adapt to it.
Sure. A few seconds is adaptable. If you're talking about the 14-minute lag time to get a message back and forth to Mars, or is it?
It can be even longer than that. It's 14 minutes. It was 14 minutes when the Curiosity rover landed to get a message one way, but that was just because of the positions of Earth and Mars. It can actually be much longer because Mars can be and Earth can be on opposite ends of from the sun.
Mm-hmm. So, and to bounce a message back to it is obviously twice the going rate. So, yeah, 28 minutes between your robot and yourself is a really long time. You're like, all right, I'm driving towards this cliff.
Right.
Oh, crap.
Like, oh, I fell off that cliff half an hour ago and I wasn't aware of it. Yeah. It's actually a real issue. So, we'll talk a little bit more about the latency and lag in just a second. But before we do that, let's talk about another thing that's really cool. We have a story about something that is much closer to having a robotic avatar than any of these. I mean, its actual purpose is to have that sense of ability to move around in an environment on behalf of someone.
Right. Well, a true robotic avatar, kind of like you've seen, I don't know, in the movie Avatar or something.
What? Is that the one with M. Night Shyamalan, the little kid who can control.
You can stop talking.
Air.
So in any of these movies where you have somebody who assumes sort of a robot body, like they plug their brain into something
right.
Now they're controlling a robot. That's sort of the idea of, you know, you have a robot avatar. It acts on your behalf. You sort of become the robot mentally.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing like that exists today.
Shucks.
But people are working on things like that. For example, robots that are sort of on one hand giving you feedback through at least visual kind of screen information. Mm-hmm. Ideally, it could be some kind of virtual reality or augmented reality feedback. But then you can also control them with your mind.
Yeah. So this is referencing a really cool report that we saw in IO9. Researchers at the CNRS-AIST Joint Robotics Laboratory and the CNRS-LIRMM Interactive Digital Human Group.
They need to work on some of those easily pronounceable acronyms.
Bob and LIRM.
Alice. LIRM. It's a great acronym. What are you talking about?
IST and LIRM, which sound like the aliens from Futurama almost.
LIRM.
So these two groups have collaborated on a project that could allow for thought-controlled robotics.
And there have been lots of experiments in recent years about thought-controlled robotics.
Yeah, exactly. Some of which require invasive surgery in order to implant electrodes. Some of which use more of a contact thing, like an EEG cap.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. So typically what we see today is that you can do a lot more with surgical implants.
Yeah.
But the goal that people are working on is to try to be able to have significant thought control of for a brain-computer interface with non-invasive methods like an EEG cap on your head, so you don't have to get surgery if you want to control a robot.
Right.
It's a lot easier sell to say, like, hey, you might want to shave a little patch on your head than it is to say, like, hey, can we drill a hole in your skull? We'll fix it, we promise.
Yeah. Yeah, it is definitely a big leap there, right? So this particular one, they're calling robotic re-embodiment.
Hmm.
And again, the person who is controlling the robot wears an EEG cap to send commands to the robot. So there's a training process, obviously, where you have to both, you know, train the robot how to respond to certain stimuli that are created by the thoughts, you know, that are converted into electrical signals. Then you also have to train the person who's wearing the cap so that they are, in fact, concentrating on whatever task they want the robot to do. Now, this particular approach is intended for people who have suffered paralysis. So, again, the idea of giving them some more control over their lives by having this robot be able to do things on their behalf by them actually controlling it with their thoughts. And there's even an AI component to it, which makes sense, because otherwise the person wearing the cap would have to do everything to control the robot. And we haven't reached that point where we can feel like our brains are actually inside this robotic body. The robotic body is really just an extension of our own abilities.
Yeah, and it's usually very simple commands.
Yeah, our EEG reading is not that good.
Yeah. So for something like walk down the hall, you might, you know, you're looking at a screen that's showing you what the robot, quote unquote, can see based upon cameras that are in the robot. And the picture that they had was of a humanoid robot.
Yeah.
So that was pretty cool. You could look at, say, a point down the hall, and the AI would take over and walk the robot for you down the hallway. So you didn't have to think, all right, now I have to lift the left leg of the robot and set it down.
Right.
It would do all of that automatically, which makes sense. So it's it's marrying remote control with AI. Some autonomous behavior so that it can complete certain tasks. But then other things you could, you know, think, I want to pick up that glass, and the robot would presumably, if it's everything's working properly, reach out an arm, pick up the thing you wanted and bring it to you.
Yeah. Another thing in that realm that's obviously much simpler is telepresence robots.
Yeah.
I mean, these are almost, When you see how some of them are implemented, it's kind of like, oh, that counts as a robot.
Yeah.
But it does. I mean, imagine, like, for example, an iPad doing FaceTime on top of a scooter that scoots around.
Like a little Segway.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, that's a telepresence robot.
And I've seen those. I mean, you know, some of them look like it looks like it's a handle that's connected to two wheels. So it doesn't even look like it's a Segway type thing even. But the handle has a frame into which you can put a tablet like an iPad. you run the software, which allows for two-way communication. So the person who wants to control the robot would use their own mobile device or computer or whatever, which would have a camera trained on them. So their face would show up in that iPad. You would have a little framed picture of whomever is using it. Like I use the example of your boss, just as general, your boss who goes and travels a lot uses this to check up on employees and could control the movements of the robot remotely. So you'd have your own little on your device. If you're the boss, you would have some sort of controls to guide where the robot could go. And you would have a view from the camera, the forward facing camera on whatever tablet or whatever device you have plugged into that. And then you could roll up and interrupt people at work and ask them what they're doing and make sure that they're being, you know, productive and not getting on Facebook for the 40th time in a row or whatever.
Or, you know, you could go up to the water cooler and participate in a conversation.
Yeah.
Now, granted, not participate in the water. That would be a terrible idea.
Yeah, a bad choice for a robot, really.
I can't wait till somebody comes up with the great hacks for these things where they can make it seem like you're working through your telepresence robot, because it plays video of you like saying, "Hi, how you doing?" as it rolls around the office, but really you're out bowling.
Yeah. Well, and also, I mean, you can really defy the expectations of your robo boss by simply walking into a room that has a door and closing it behind you, because this is a robot that's literally on wheels and nothing else.
So it has no hands.
Yeah, you would have to.
I read about these, actually. They can knock on a door just by ramming into the door a few times. That was in an article I read.
Yeah, yeah. And the other explanations I have seen have suggested that perhaps like really forward-thinking offices, not our forward-thinking office, but in general, could have automatic doors installed.
Right, so that help fix this problem.
Yeah, there's a little motion sensor, and then it opens up automatically, and then your robo boss rolls on in to chat with you.
We're ruining all of Joe's dreams by suggesting this right now.
Yeah, he much prefers just the picture of our boss ramming into a door repeatedly in order to get it to open.
Enter!
At any rate, this telepresence approach is something that already exists. Again, it doesn't give you the experience that Chris was talking about, obviously.
Well, part of that is the fact that our virtual reality or augmented reality systems are not up to snuff enough to make us feel like we are that robot.
Yeah, to embody a robot or to embody yourself within a robot, how would be the best way to say that? I don't know. However, to become a robot.
To become the robot.
You really do need some kind of VR. Like, FaceTime is not good enough.
Yeah, I mean, VR is one of those things. It's funny because some of the earliest implementations of virtual reality were military implementations, and they were to give people a better view of what was around whatever vehicle they might have been in. So pilots were using this, for example, in order to get a good view underneath the aircraft if they had to drop something off at a particular target, or people inside an armored vehicle. Obviously, the armored vehicle is an important element of keeping personnel safe. And if you were to, I don't know, put a lot of windows in it, it becomes less safe.
Right.
So what you do is you end up mounting cameras on the actual armored vehicle that point out in different directions. And then you can have a head-mounted display. And by turning your head, it actually automatically signals which camera view you start to get.
Yeah, and can access them and, hypothetically in 360 degrees around you.
Yeah, I've seen some really cool implementations of this where it has that sort of seamless overlapping technology. It's mm-hmm. It's not that different from stitching together photographs to make a panoramic image.
Right.
Except it's doing it in video, which is kind of crazy.
Which is really hard. Yeah.
but these are examples of, again, kind of marrying that idea of a mechanical presence and allowing you the ability to perceive as if you were that thing. Because it's not your view of your surroundings. Your view of the surroundings is the interior of that vehicle. It's mm-hmm. the view of the vehicle and within its surroundings. Right. So that's kind of, you know, you extend that to a robot, like a humanoid robot, and you could say, oh, that would totally work. If I have a head mounted display with head tracking, and when I turn my head, the robot changes its perspective, whether it turns a head or just a camera
rotates.
Or
cameras,
yeah, exactly.
Sure.
Yeah, that's kind of one argument for the fact that if we were to try to create robotic avatars, they should probably be basically humanoid robots.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to be able to, you know, inhabit the headspace of something that's not at least sort of shaped like a human.
The further away you get from the human shape, the more effort it's going to take on the part of the human controlling it to do so in a way that feels natural. Now, it's not, and that's, I don't think that's an insurmountable challenge, and we'll get into that a little bit.
Yeah,
but
I think it's probably easier in the long run to get human pilots used to controlling a rolling robot than it is to create a bipedal.
Yeah, building a robot that's humanoid that is capable of doing
love.
Things like, I was thinking of picking itself up when it fell over. Really, that's a big challenge.
Well, those Boston Dynamics people are.
Yeah, those robots
they're on it.
Moving
to be
creepily
fair, though,
forward.
Those robots are
galloping,
four-legged.
Creepily
however.
Forward.
No, they're working on two-legged robots.
Oh, that's
too.
True.
They've
there been, is the one that was running on
the
treadmill.
Oof.
Well, at any rate, let's those talk about some of those challenges.
Yeah, well, one of the big ones, obviously, so what did Chris ask about? We were talking about robotic avatars specifically mentioned for space exploration, right?
Right. And Chris had said perhaps we would be able to use something like quantum communication to get around the lag and latency issues we have. So, for example, the Curiosity rover, when we were landing that, when the team was landing that, I had nothing to do with it. I was covering it, which was cool, but I had no direct involvement. When the team was landing or observing the Curiosity rover's landing, we were doing that knowing that the events we're watching had already happened, right? That it had taken that 14 mm-hmm. minutes for information to get back to us. And technically, we're looking at what happened 14 minutes ago. So there was a time where the robot was either safe on the surface of Mars or had crashed and was, completely lost to us. And we had no way of knowing. We just had to wait for that time to catch up so that we would find out what had happened, which is kind of crazy when you think about it. You're like, oh, this is an event that had occurred one way or another, but we had to wait until the information could get to us before we learned of it.
Very briefly with Schrodinger's rover.
Yeah, it's true. It kind of really was Schrodinger's rover. So that's a great way of saying, what about quantum communication? Now, I'm not entirely certain what Chris was trying to say because there wasn't a full explanation of it. So I might be misinterpreting what Chris was saying. And if so, I do apologize. However, I got to address this in that the way we use the term quantum communication does not mean instantaneous communication, mm-hmm. which seemed to be what Chris was saying, but I'm not entirely certain.
And this is partially just a terminology thing, but yeah, so what does quantum communication mean?
All right, now generally that refers to using the principles of quantum physics, which we recently talked about in our random number generator episode, where using quantum physics to create like truly random numbers. At least they appear to be truly random. Again, based upon all of our observations, right?
Mm-hmm.
As far as we can tell, it's truly random. And it's to use those to create keys for cryptographic purposes so you can be assured that any messages you send to someone using this methodology are completely secure across the channel as long as that session is active. But it doesn't speed up that transmission. The transmission itself still takes place over more classical communication media. So you're limited by the speed of light, ultimately. You can't go faster than that.
It's pretty fast.
It's
but
fast.
Over long distances, it's not really fast enough.
And
it's not instantaneous. Yeah.
We can't use quantum communication for really long distances. We're limited by the actual limitations of quantum mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, the truly optimistic believe that maybe we're talking 500 kilometers range max. In real life, we're talking closer to 150, 200 kilometers or so being worked on now.
And I would point out that although longer than a car, is still shorter than the distance to other solar systems.
Yeah, significantly not interstellar range here.
You know, one idea that this might be related to, though, is the one of quantum entanglement.
And that might be what Chris was referring to. And again, if I'm wrong, I do apologize. But there has been discussion of quantum entanglement, which is a truly odd thing to, concept to us on the classical level.
Spooky, even, yes, you might say.
It's spooky action at a distance, as I'm certain Albert Einstein would have said, and did say, in fact. He didn't. Not would have. He did. So the concept here is a little mind-bending, yeah. All right? So you've got
though these, I think also sometimes misunderstood.
It can very easily be misunderstood.
Well, so it's kind of weird.
Yeah. So on the quantum level, you can get these quantum particles, subatomic particles, that are entangled with one another. So their states correlate with one another. They don't.
Right.
They don't necessarily match.
But if you know something about one, you automatically know something about the other one.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of different quantum states we could talk about, like the polarization of light or the spin of an electron. Let's go with spin. So let's say that you could describe spin as being either up or down. That's just two directions that we could talk about. But we'll limit it for this purpose. And if you have two entangled electrons, one is spinning, and you measure one, and it's spinning up. You know that the other one, because it's entangled, is spinning down. It's the opposite direction. You know that because of the fact that they are entangled. Now, here's where it gets kind of crazy. These two particles will remain entangled no matter how far apart they are. So you could take those two entangled particles, take one to one side of the galaxy, the other to the other side of the galaxy. They're separated by the entire Milky Way. And if you measure one, you know what the other one's state was at the moment that you measured yours.
Yours, right.
Because they were entangled.
Yeah.
So some people have suggested that this is faster than light communication. But if you really stretch your mind, you realize that locality has not necessarily been violated, because you already knew that the two were entangled, right?
Mm-hmm.
You already knew that. And by measuring it, all you've done is determine what state they were in at that moment. And if you wanted to try and do an experiment where you communicated some way using this, it all falls apart. So let's talk about an example, because otherwise this is going to get super, super complicated. And then I'll talk about some of the arguments about quantum entanglement, because it's not a settled issue at all. I want to use this example, though. All right. So I give Lauren an electron. Don't say I never gave you anything.
No, well, thank you, Jonathan.
I give Joe an electron that's entangled with Lauren's electron.
We're buddies. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
You're always putting burdens on me.
I ship you guys to opposite ends of the galaxy.
Wait a minute.
Well,
thank
you,
sir.
And at this point, I am no longer involved in the communication of the two of them. However, so Lauren decides she's going to measure her electron, see which way it's spinning.
Uh-huh.
She sees that it's spinning up. She knows that Joe's electron, therefore, is spinning down. Now, Joe, if you were to measure yours and you saw it was spinning down, you would know that Lauren's was spinning up. But you haven't communicated anything yet.
Yeah, and what we really want to say to each other at this point is like, man, Jonathan sucks.
Right,
yeah.
So let's say that Lauren sends the message, man, Jonathan sucks, along with, oh, by the way, your electron is spinning down. It would have to go across classical communications channels, thus traveling at best the speed of light across the galaxy. So even though you could measure the electron and know what state Joe's electron was in, the actual message about that information would still be limited by the speed of light. If you wanted to change the spin of your electron, as if you could, like, hey, Joe, whenever your electron is spinning down, it means this. And whenever it's spinning up, it means this. I'll control my electron from over here. You just watch yours. Everything will be fine. If you try to change the state of your electron, Lauren, entanglement breaks.
Right.
So Joe could still be observing the electron, and the spin could be changing, but it would no longer be connected to the state of Lauren's electron. It would just be random.
Right. So, it's no longer in superposition. It has been affected by a macro scale system.
And now Joe would be thinking that Lauren's talking crazy talk because it would just be random messages based upon whatever code you guys had worked out previously.
So there is no way to send the message, man, Jonathan sucks.
Not through quantum entanglement, as far as we understand right now. However, that being said, this is far from a settled matter in quantum physics.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So first we've got...
So you're admitting everything you just said is wrong.
I'm admitting that everything I said could be wrong.
Yeah. Man, Jonathan
I am
sucks.
Allowing for the...
Sorry.
No.
First of all, I am saying
Come
that
on,
Jonathan
no.
sucks is
we,
wrong.
We accept the burden of proper scientific humility
yes,
on this
do.
Show.
We right. do, we do, yes.
So it could be wrong. So first of all, this was an idea that Einstein hated. He did not like the idea of particles being able to be entangled with one another and that this could potentially lead to something like faster than light communication. He called it spooky action from a distance.
Of course, nature doesn't owe us liking it.
That's true. That's true. And there have been people who pointed out that there are loopholes within quantum mechanics that could potentially allow for a more classical explanation of the behaviors of those subatomic particles that does not involve entanglement. In other words, we have the illusion of entanglement, but in reality, something else is happening. So, for example, there's a story about how you could use an instrument to measure the various states of quantum particles and thus see the entanglement. But people have pointed out that perhaps the instrument of measurement itself has communicated the state of one to the other using classical means, so it's the speed of light is your limiting factor. So, in other words, we're talking about non-sentient things essentially communicating with one another. That's what happens at the quantum level, guys. So, in other words, the whole thing ends up being what some folks would call a conspiracy. That one subatomic
particle. A
conspiracy
of quantums?
Yeah. So, like one subatomic particle, once you've determined what spin it is, the other one is told, quote unquote, that through the instrumentation. And ends up spinning the other way. Now, there's also the talk about how perhaps there could be some set of events that creates this illusion of the two particles being entangled with one another. And that, in fact, you could almost think of it in terms of fate, that the steps you take to make those measurements, in fact, determine the effect you get. And so you see the effect of entanglement, but the effect really isn't there. You have created it yourself. And this is kind of a concept called setting independence. Like, how do you determine that your actions did not lead to this? So there's a proposed experiment I read about. This was in an article that I read back in November of 2014. That's kind of crazy. And here's the proposed test. You've got a particle detector. And it has different settings that you can use to measure subatomic particles, right? And if you were to choose which setting you wanted, like, quote unquote, consciously choose.
You would choose liquefy.
You could be setting into motion the series of events that determine that both of these particles appear to be entangled.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, you are the cause. It's not truly entangled. You have caused this to happen.
Right.
So they wanted to say, let's take all of this chance out of it. What we're going to do is we're going to look for the oldest light we can detect in the universe. So in other words, the furthest light source we can possibly find as soon as it hits Earth for the first time. So
maybe the CMBR.
I don't know if they're looking at cosmic background radiation or not. But what they are doing is they're looking for bright lights that are the furthest away from us as possible. In other words, we've just detected the light for the first time. We've never detected it before.
Sure.
And they're looking for a couple different sources. And preferably those sources have to be far enough from each other so that their light could never have touched one another before that moment. So that means this light could not have interacted with anything before that specific moment, and then taking basically the millisecond of when it hits as if it's an even number, then it's a zero. If it's an odd number, it's a one or something along those lines. You then determine what setting you use your particle detector. And the argument is that if, in fact, this means that events have come together to cause the illusion of entanglement to happen, they must date all the way back to the Big Bang. So either the particles are truly entangled, or everything has been predestined from the Big Bang. Or they're not truly entangled.
By that big turtle.
Possibly. So that's kind of crazy. But, you know,
all right.
At any rate, even...
Well, that's one of the weirdest things we've ever talked about, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty weird. So there are also some physicists who are looking into the possibility of maybe there is some way of working around this quantum entanglement for communication purposes. But from what I understand, the prevailing thought in the discipline is that it is not likely to be possible.
That, yeah, that it's really just an interesting phenomenon and is perhaps not practical in any way.
Well, also, I mean, you have to take relativistic physics into account where didn't Einstein or some other physicists experiment sort of in their thoughts with the idea of the tachyon telephone? The tachyons are the particles that travel faster than light, and if you could send a signal to someone through tachyons, apparently it would arrive before it was sent.
Now, tachyons, of course, are hypothetical.
Right.
We don't
have no evidence they actually exist.
It's convenient for math right now.
Sure.
So another challenge besides the communication one, I mean, obviously that one's huge, right? Because if we are to send robots out into the galaxy to explore, then if we are limited by the speed of light, for communication purposes, we're never going to get that real-time experience.
Well, I want to propose a solution that I think we may have talked about a long time ago when we were talking about space exploration earlier on in the existence or the history of this podcast, which is sort of robotic avatars enabled by teams of astronauts who don't exactly go straight into the monster's mouth. So say you've got to explore the surface of some moon or asteroid or something like that, and you want to do it with a robotic avatar, something that has the judgment and foresight and control of a human while having all those wonderful advantages that robots provide, you could, for example, have a spacecraft orbiting this object.
Right.
And then from that spacecraft, you could have a human who dons control gloves or an exoskeleton of some kind and a VR headset, and then becomes that robotic probe that's down on the surface and is close enough to communicate without too much latency.
And Chris actually brought that to light as well, saying that that could be a possibility for something like exploring Mars or even setting up a colony for Mars in the future where, you know, we talked about the Mars One proposed plan, which we need to do an update on, I think, at some point, just to talk about some of the information that's come to light since the plan started.
Mm-hmm. Some wonderfully sketchy information.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot to talk about. I think maybe we do need to revisit that at some point. But at any rate, there was talk of using robots to build the habitats that the Martian colonists would be living in.
Yeah, not a bad idea.
Yeah, and this approach would make a lot of sense too, being able to have that real-time control or close to real-time control of robots by using an orbiting space station of some sort or even just a spacecraft with people on it that would then be directly controlling the robots on the surface. The delay would be much shorter.
It's a lot safer that way. You don't have human construction workers down there breathing in all of those delicious perchlorates.
That would be good.
The Martian soil.
Yeah, that's not great for your lungs, breathing all that in. So,
didn't we talk about licking Mars dust earlier?
Yeah.
Yes, we did. Yeah, that was one of the first things you said, Joe, in this episode.
Nom.
So yeah, I think the communication challenge is probably the biggest one that we have, especially once you start talking about going beyond our solar system. I don't know that we're going to solve that without some other breakthrough discovery that allows for some faster than light communication. But there are some other challenges too. We need to make sure that whatever robots we create are safe for whatever their purpose is. So for the example of robots here on Earth, if we want to have a robot like the one that was reported by in IO9, we need to make sure that it's going to be safe to be around you know, as with other humans, right? You don't want a robot that would be capable of harming someone through, and, you know, whatever action it may take. Mm-hmm. You know, like if you ever go to a manufacturing plant with one of those giant industrial robots, they have these enormous areas set up around them to mm-hmm. prevent people from getting too close.
Yeah.
It's deadly.
And bumpers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Sure. Which is less of a problem if you're right on Mars because
sure.
no one else is walking
yeah.
around down there.
Like, yeah. What are you going to do? Shove over a Martian? I mean, Joe's robot.
I hope not. That Martian, we're going to start a world war. Yeah.
Q-38 space modulator or whatever it was.
In reality, I would only make peace-loving robots.
You're the one who had all the shoving ones. I'm just saying.
Those weren't mine.
Okay. It was just hypothetical robots.
Hypothetical robots that would probably belong to Jonathan.
All right, let's be fair. All right, so anyway, you know, you all obviously would need to build a robot that was going to be, you know, well-designed for whatever environment it was going to go into. This kind of goes back to, you know, having a robot with wheels as opposed to legs because it's more stable.
Or tracks even, yeah.
Yeah, or and it may not have the same number of limbs that we have, so it may be that it has a single articulated arm or it could have a whole bunch of articulated arms. The user interface would have to be designed to allow for that, right? Mm-hmm. Depending upon how much autonomy you gave the robot versus remote control. If you want the true sense of being present in that robot, then you want as much of that control as possible.
Right.
Otherwise, it feels like you're just a passive audience member watching a movie or something as opposed mm-hmm. to the person who's actually making things happen.
Yeah.
And we'd have to make an interface that makes sense based upon what the robot is capable of. If the robot is able to gather a lot more information than our human senses can detect, we have to have that information presented in a way that makes sense to us, the human operator. Right? Because we can't see in every spectrum or we can't hear certain noises. Do we have that converted into what we can hear? How do we indicate that it would be normally beyond our range of sensing? These are little questions that we have to answer in order for this to make sense. And then, of course, we just have to train people how to use these robots whenever we do develop them. And mm-hmm. that's probably the easiest because humans are pretty plastic with the brains, right?
And, you know, just looking at the different number of video games that any given human can play, I'd say that we're pretty capable of moving through an environment with a avatar that does not move exactly how we do.
I agree. Yeah, it's a good example. Although it does mean that whenever you switch from one type of robot to another, you got to have that, you know, 5 to 10 minutes of, oh, that's right, be in this one means that I end up shocking a person as opposed to handing them the cup of hot cocoa I made them. That would be important to know.
Yeah, and the left shoulder trigger in this one isn't poke the button, it's fire a rocket launcher.
Right.
That's good to remember.
Yeah.
Good to remember.
I hope whenever they design robotic avatars, they don't have any controls that rely on joystick clicks. I mean, the worst.
How do you sprint? Click the left thumbstick. Oh! Well, that wraps up this discussion. I want to thank Chris for that amazing email.
Yeah.
It was really a phenomenal message, and I wish we could have read the whole thing, but we would have had to have a second episode. But I do welcome all those kinds of messages to come on in because it's fantastic to hear from you. We love knowing what you guys want to hear more about, and we welcome that kind of message. So you can send us an email. That email address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com, or you can drop us a line on Facebook, Twitter, or Google Plus. At Twitter and Google Plus, we are fwthinking. Over on Facebook, just search fwthinking in the search bar. We'll pop right up. Leave us a message, and we'll talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts.
But we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, The Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Check the backseat. Check the backseat.
All right, come here.
Check the backseat.
Gets in your head, right? Good. Because every year, dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them. But with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the backseat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.